What? What was?
Oh, that one page, it's probably.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
That's
sorry about the delay.
Oh, that's okay. Right. We didn't even get started.
This is different? Yeah.
It's just last session.
This is last session?
Yeah.
Where are the tests, Professor?
The one page this summer. They're like 325 copies, so they're probably somebody has a whole stack of them somewhere. Okay. Don't worry if you don't get them. It's the same thing I sent you this morning.
Email.
Yeah.
I'm going to take the day.
Okay. That's just from last session, nothing new.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing new. Okay. That's just from last session, nothing new. Just that page, yeah. Take this stack back with you. Just take it back and put it somewhere back there. Nothing new here. Just last sessions. Don't pick up anything if you picked up last sessions. Okay. There's nothing new in there. That's all from last session. So nothing new in there.
Yeah, I didn't
there.
Get
okay.
last yeah. session as well. I didn't get...
You weren't here last session?
No, I just transferred it.
Just two handouts?
Three.
Right.
There should be a syllabus too. Okay, take that. That looks like a syllabus too. Yeah, this is that. There's nothing new in there. It's all last session. Okay, folks, get settled in. Nothing new in here. There's only one page. There's only one page, one just single page being handed out today. It's actually the same page that I sent you as a PDF file before the class. In fact, this is something I'm going to, from this class on, you can already see what chaos it is to try to hand out stuff in this class. So from this point on, at the most, there'll be one page in every class. I will usually send it out as an email with a PDF connector. So basically, you should have it already. So this is like fallback. If you don't print off whatever you know, I send it out. So otherwise, this is like, you know, I'm fighting mass chaos up front. So this, you know, so that's kind of going to be pretty much par for the course. So let's start with today's start of the class test. This is going to be a weird exercise. Here's what I'm going to do. At the beginning of each class, I'm actually going to do a test of what we're going to do during the class. You think that's ass backwards, right? Basically, you do the class and then you do the test. I have a different test for this, but this test is actually going to be about concepts we haven't covered, and I'm going to ask you questions, and I'm going to try to get you to answer these questions. And what you're going to discover in most of these classes is that you get the answer to the question before we actually do the class, and that is intentional. Because if you're able to think through things in a common sense way, there's nothing I'm going to say that is so incredibly profound that it should turn your thinking upside down. So we're going to talk about bias in today's class. It's the most dangerous force in valuation, but it's almost unstoppable, and you're going to see why when I start describing to you circumstances. And I want you to think about if you were in this circumstance, and I will describe the circumstance, whether you're going to be inclined to bias your value upwards or bias your value downwards. You ready? You're the owner of a private business. You're valuing your business for sale to somebody else. It's an easy one. Bias up, bias down, no bias. Come on, don't think too long. Because if you think too long, it'll get you into trouble. You want to push your value up. And how are you going to do that? What are the devices under your control to make your business look more, make your business look more valuable? Let's take item by item. You're going to give me high growth or low growth? You're going to tell me your company is going to grow high, a lot without reinvesting very much. And you're also going to tell me that your business is very risky or very safe. So you're basically going to tell me the story about a high-growth business that is really safe and try to get me to pay a high price. Let's switch roles. You're now a venture capitalist looking at this exact same business. You know how venture capital works, right? I supply you capital as a business, and I demand a share of your... You've seen Shark Tank, so you kind of know. Right? That's pretty... So if you're a venture capitalist looking at this business, bias up, bias down, or no bias? You want down, and what do you... By lowering the value of your business, what benefit do I get out of that? It's not that I supply the same capital. I'm not supplying you less capital. But what do I get in return? A much higher... And this is why I said, watch Shark Tank. Watch Kevin, right? You ask for $10 million for 10%, and he says $5 million for 80%. Somewhere in the middle you negotiate. But I want to buy you down. And again, I'm going to find my ways. I'm going to lower your growth, that high growth you gave me. I said, no, I don't see the growth. I'm going to make your safe business into a risky business. And ergo, I'm going to end up with a low value. Now, let's start making things even more interesting. You're valuing your business. You're now married. You're on the verge of breaking up. You're valuing your business for divorce court. Come on, somebody's got to do it. Half your value is going to go to your soon-to-be ex-spouse, who you don't like anymore. Bias up, bias down. Basically, you're going to say, there's no value in this business. Half of zero is zero. Take it or leave it. Again, you're going to find ways to do it. Henry Ham, the Texas multi-billionaire, about 2 years ago, had divorced his wife. This is a guy who built up a $4 billion business. And he went in front of court and he said, I'm a useless manager. My business is terrible. I think it's worth nothing. Therefore, give my wife half of nothing. It didn't quite work, but you can see how bias kicks in. You're an appraiser for the owner of a business, and you're appraising the value of your business so that you can pay taxes on that value. It's like an estate tax. So whatever value you come up with, you have to pay 40% of that in taxes. Bias up, bias down. You can see why, right? But the lower you make the value, the less tax you pay. Now switch roles. You're the appraiser for the IRS looking at the same business. You want to push the value up, because then you collect more in taxes. Same business, same information. You can see how bias kicks into value. Now let's make this about bankers. I'm going to say some awful things about bankers, but I mean every word of it. I know most of you will end up as bankers. Take it for whatever it's worth. Don't take it personally or take it personally. I really don't care, right? So let's play some banking bias questions. You know how equity research is structured globally? There's sell-side equity research and buy-side equity research. Can somebody tell me the difference? What's sell-side equity research? Yeah.
They're like banks, basically, and depending on that, they make the buy and sell reports.
Right. In fact, any time you read about an equity research report, it's coming from sell-side equity research, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America. So you go to work for an equity research department. You're given 15 or 20 companies to follow for the rest of your life. It's kind of a depressing thought. And every month you come out with buy and sell recommendations. Buy this, sell this. So you think your job is valuation and telling people what to buy. So I'm going to ask you a question. You become a sell-side equity research analyst for Goldman Sachs. This is the pinnacle of your existence, right? What you've aspired through Stern. You're there. What are you going to do with the rest of your life now? And I ask you, now you're following 15 companies. You claim to be valuing companies. We'll come back and ask a question whether equity research analysts actually value companies. That's a different question. Do you think there's a bias up, bias down, or bias unclear? What's the question I'm asking you? Who do you work for, right? I mean, think about it. You value these companies. You put out recommendations. The recommendations go to portfolio managers who presumably use those to make decisions. I think at some level you'd want to be fair because you want these people. But why, you're right, it's bias up. But why do you think it's bias up? What is it about the equity research process that leads you? I'll give away some numbers. There are 8 times more buy recommendations than sell recommendations. So obviously the bias up has backing. So why do you think there's a bias up?
Are there two possible
Trade volume, I mean, back up. Trading volume where? But how do you make money as an investment bank from increasing trading and volume in the overall market? Okay, so basically you're saying maybe, but you could get as much trading or volume with a strong sell recommendation as a buy recommendation. So, okay, now we're on to something. I said you're going to follow 15 companies for the rest of your life, right? So what do? You develop sources. You're like a journalist following a politician, right? You develop sources, and you've got to be very careful about not crossing that line of legality. The SEC actually says this is okay. But you develop sources in these companies. You put a buy recommendation, they're happy with you. They keep you as a person that they'll feed information. You put out one sell recommendation. Guess what happens? You call the company, nobody picks up your phone. You burnt your sources, and this is your only differential advantage that you've talked to the company. I sympathize with equity research analysts when they say, if I put a sell recommendation, I will never be able to speak to this company again. And that's one of the 15 companies I follow. So guess what sell-side equity research does when they don't want you to buy a stock? They've developed this really weaselly way of doing it. They have strong buy, weak buy. What the hell is that, a weak buy? How do I do that? I sit in front of my computer and hit the key to buy tentatively. That's a very weak buy. I hit it strongly. Right? Basically, it exists for one reason and one reason alone. When an equity research analyst says, I've lowered this company from a strong buy to a weak buy, he's actually saying, sell, 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 but I can't say that word. So equity research analysts bias upwards? Yes, for lots of different reasons. And it gets worse if the investment bank gets investment banking revenues from the company you're tracking. So if you're Goldman Sachs equity research analyst following Tesla, and Goldman Sachs is Tesla's investment banker, obviously the conflicts of interest push you even further into biasing up. This was actually the heart of the 2001 problem where bankers were actually pulled in front of court and you know, there were new rules were put in to prevent that conflict. It doesn't go away, but it's just gone to the background. Let's say you're a buy-side analyst. Who's a buy-side analyst? What kinds of, you know, who would be a buy-side analyst? Sell-side analysts, obviously, the people who work at Goldman Sachs and Bank of America putting out these recommendations and stock. Where do buy-side analysts work? Basically, the Fidelities, the Janus's, the Rowe Prices, and they're higher analysts, they're buy-side analysts. So you actually operate in complete anonymous surroundings because you really, you know, do analyses for your portfolio managers in your firm. You think that buy-side analysts shouldn't have the bias that sell-side analysts do because you don't have to worry about keeping companies happy because you track hundreds of companies. You got to keep your portfolio manager happy, right? So let's see if this could potentially be some bias. I'm your portfolio manager. I already own 1 million shares of IBM. And I ask you to do some research in IBM to tell me whether it's a good stock or a bad stock. Let's boil this down to basic. You can come to one of two conclusions, right? It's a good stock or a bad stock. Which will make me happier? I already own 1 million shares of IBM. I'm going to be pretty pissed off if you now come and say that was a bad stock. So this goes in the back of your head as you're working through your research. You're saying that's not scientific. Valuation is not scientific. We already established that. It's not a science. Your bias, if I already own the stock, is to bias the value up because you want to tell me that I did the right thing. And if I've sold short in the stock, it's to bias down because, again, you want to tell me that I did the right thing. Now let's get to the most biased process of all, which is M&A. You have a friendly merger. You know what a friendly merger is, right? Two companies coming together. The managers of both companies want the merger to go through. You're the bankers for the two companies. So you guys be the acquiring company bankers. You guys be the target company bankers. You want this deal to go through. You, more than everybody else, want this deal to go through. Both sides, right? Why? How do bankers get paid on an M&A deal? If the deal goes through, there's no you did a good job, provided good advice kind of fee. It's did the deal go through fee. Already I've raised the stakes in terms of bias. But you have a very interesting task. Because to convince your shareholders that the deal is a good deal, You each have to tell opposing stories. So let's start with you. You're the acquiring company bankers. You got to convince the acquiring company shareholders that they're getting a good deal on this acquisition, which means what? That the value of the target company is less than what you paid for it, right? You're saying, what's the big deal? Let's go to this side. You're the target company shareholders at exactly the same point in time with exactly the same numbers in front of you. You got to convince your shareholders that what's being paid by them is less than your value or more than your value? More than your value. This is going to be really tough to pull off, right? Basically, if you want to get a good deal here, you want this deal to go through, and you both have to push in the same direction. And the friendly takeover, you might be able to pull it off by pulling in whatever you need to out of the process. But in friendly takeovers, everybody in that room wants to get the deal to go through because the acquiring company manager, the acquiring company banker, the target company manager, the target company bankers are all pulling in the same direction. Actually, let me take that right. In the friendly merger, you both have the same task, right? That the price being paid. So basically, you walk away with some way of getting away with this. Now, let's make this a hostile takeover. Now, you're the acquiring company banker. And you got to your standard task. You now want to stop the deal. As a target company banker, your job is to convince your shareholders that they're getting a bad deal. Right? So you want to push up your value and say, hey, those guys are not paying enough. They should come back with a higher price. I personally think that valuation in M&A is a waste of money and a waste of time. The value of a target company is whatever you decide to pay for it plus $10. Why do we go through these shenanigans of acting like you're valuing something to justify it? Because the reality is the process is way too biased for you to deliver an honest answer to me. So today we're going to talk about bias, how difficult it is to get away from bias once you start getting paid to do valuation. And many of you will be in jobs where you're paid. So once you get paid, but even if you don't get paid, which is the case of in this class, so if you're thinking I'm going to pay you to do the value of your companies, let that go. But each of you is going to be picking a company to value. And in fact, this might be a good time to actually gather together what you need to do on the project because... So let me review what you need to do on the project because it's going to set up why you need to think about bias. How many of you have been able to form a group already? Let me repeat the question. How many of you already have been able to find a group already? This is not good. So I will keep asking this question. Not in a group or in a group? This is in a group, right? The hands went up. So the rest of you are not in a group. What the hell are you guys doing? The good people will go. So go get them now, right? So I need you to find a group before the end of this week. Okay. Let me repeat that. I want you to find a group before the end of this week. Don't wait till 3 weeks in or 5 weeks in. Okay. Don't try to do it now, talking to each other. This is not the right time, right after class maybe. So step one is find a group. Step two is pick a company. In fact, step two can come before step one. There's no sequencing adopted. So if you have a company that you already have in mind that you'd like to value, go ahead. The only constraint is that somebody in the group has to pick a money-losing company, somebody has to pick a high-growth company, somebody has to pick an emerging market company. So if your company that you're thinking of is a money-losing company or a high-growth company, that's already an advantage. Okay? That's the second step. Everything we're going to do in this class, we're going to do on that company. So we're going to start with discounted cash flow valuation, intrinsic valuation. I'm going to value companies that I want to value, but you're going to take the techniques we talk about in class, and you're going to do an intrinsic or a discounted cash flow valuation of your company. That part of the project, I will give you a mid-semester reprieve where if you want to, only if you want to, you can turn in your valuations to me, and I'll give you feedback without a grade on, hey, maybe you want to fix this, maybe... You don't have to. If you feel absolutely confident in your technique and your abilities, I'm okay with that too. We get to pricing, you're going to price your company. When we do option pricing approach and valuation, if it applies, you're going to apply that in your company. So by the time we get to the end of the semester, you're going to have a discounted cash flow valuation of your company. You're going to have a pricing of your company, maybe multiple pricings, depending on the multiple and who you compare them to. You might even have an option pricing value. And on May 8th, I'm going to ask you a question. And this will be the closure on your project. I'm saying, you come up with a number for your company. You know what the price is. Would you buy or would you sell? Not would you strong buy, would you weak buy, would you weak sell? No. I will give you this very small room in the middle where which I call chicken. Buy, sell, chicken. Basically, I can't make up my mind. I want you to be able to pick because that's the essence of valuation. It's not easy. I want to force you to make the decision. So at the end of this class, you'll actually have 5 or 6 or 7 companies, so depending on the size of the group. So each person, no matter what size the group is, has to do a company. So if you have 8 people in your group, 8 companies. 4 people, 4 companies. What you will have in your final project report are really 8 valuations. There's very little group work I require in this class on this project. In my corporate finance class, it was much more group. You're saying, why do we gather together as a group? Once in a while, it's nice for you to talk to each other. And maybe there's something that you do that you can share across the group, maybe equity risk premiums. The reason I do this is actually the class I teach the second-year MBAs, usually in the last semester. And second-year MBAs, by the time they get to the last semester, are sick and tired of each other. They don't want to see each other. So I minimize group work. You don't have to see those people. And also, second-year MBAs have this bad practice, and some of your seniors will also go through this, of what I call premature graduation. This is around March. You think you've already graduated. Your brain goes off on vacation. I can't get an ounce of work out of you. That's part of the reason I require that mid-semester discounted cash flow evaluation. Before your brain leaves, why don't you do something? So the project is really about taking everything in this class and applying it. It's worth 30%, but I'll also tell you up front that the nature of this class is you don't get very many bad projects. Usually people pick up and carry the slack, so the projects are condensed at the top, but it's really to get you to try things out. There'll be a second project, which I've called a mystery project. It's a mystery project because I pick whatever might be in the news. So basically, I have lots of leeway. I might pick some merger that's right in the news in March or April and say, hey, why don't we make that a mystery project? That's a much smaller project. It's a 2-week project. It's still with that same group that you created for your big group project. And that's the 10%. So those are the 40% you get from projects. The reason I bring that up is each of you has to pick a company. You can pick whatever company you want. In fact, if you want to value a private business and you can get the information, a family business, that's okay too. I've had at least 7 or 8 IPOs come out of this class. So people valuing their private businesses who have essentially gone on to take that company public. One of them actually is a guy called Lorenzo Fertitta. He valued his casino that his father owned in Vegas called Palace Station Casinos. And they took it public. But he actually became wealthy by creating a second business. Anybody know what the second business he created, the Fertittas? He created UFC, the fighting league, and which he sold for, what, $3 billion or through $2.5 billion. I'm still waiting for my slice of that $2.5 billion, but it's not coming, right? So take a risk. Pick something you wouldn't value elsewhere because this is going to be a chance where you can try things out, go wrong in the mid-semester. I say, why don't you try this? It's a way of learning valuation. So don't view this as, I want to be risk-averse, pick a nice, safe company to value. I won't stop you if you do, but you will learn a lot less. So with that background, let me give some perspective on, so this is going to be a big picture class, laying the table for everything we're going to do in the class. When I first started teaching valuation, I made the mistake of assuming that everybody else was as interested in valuation as I was. A huge mistake, because I've discovered in hindsight that most people don't believe in valuation. By most people, including most people who do valuation for a living, don't really buy into it. So, but they do it all the time. They do it because it's their job. They do it to cover their rear ends. But if you caught them in an honest moment, or when they're drunk, which might be the same thing, they'll admit that they don't buy this valuation stuff. That ultimately, Amazon is priced at 700 because that's what the market thinks it's worth. If I believe that, I wouldn't teach this class. So I'm going to start off by telling you why I do valuation. I do valuation to fight the lemming in me. Lemmings became famous or infamous in the 1950s When first National Geographic and then Disney filmed a most amazing sight, thousands of big, ugly, rat-like creatures gathered together. Lemmings are like rats, so don't glamorize them. They're not nice-looking creatures. Gathered together on a cliff, ran right off the cliff into an ocean and committed collective suicide. And ever since, one of those big questions, I mean, where did they do it? What drives them off the cliff? I don't know the answer to that question, but let's do some virtual imagery. You can see why the first lemming did it, right? He was going too fast. He couldn't stop. Off the cliff, into the ocean. Incidentally, these guys can't swim, so that kind of seals the deal. Dead. Second guy, too close. The first guy, also in the water, also dead. But I want you to put yourself in the shoes of the very last lemming in that. I know lemmings don't wear shoes, but kind of hang in there with the analogy anywhere. Of the very last lemming in the group. You ready? You're running as fast as you can towards a cliff. You've seen your entire tribe disappear off that cliff. I would think you'd have second thoughts about what you were planning to do, right? Your left brain, right brain, whatever's rushing, stop, 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 don't do it. And then you hear this voice in the back of your head. You know what it says? They must know something that you don't. Remember those seven words. They must know something that you don't. They're the seven most deadly words in investing in valuation. I hear it all the time. I'll give you an example. I remember valuing Tesla when it was at 200. I came up with the value 120. What's my rational side saying? Stock's overvalued, don't buy it. I heard this voice in the back of my head. They must know something that you don't. It speaks in a monotone, don't ask me why. And when I hear that voice, magical things start to happen to my valuation. My growth rates start to increase. My discount rates start to decrease. My cash flows get bigger. It's almost like the spreadsheet has taken on a life of its own. 120 becomes 130, 140, 155. You can actually watch the value wandering while you watch it towards the 200. Don't fight it. There's a lemming inside each and every one of you dying to get out. Just let it out. In fact, you can divide the whole world of investors into three groups of lemmings. The first group I call proud lemmings. I'm a lemming and I'm proud to be a lemming. They call themselves momentum investors. But it's pretty much the same thing. You know what they do? They look for a crowd, they join in. You're buying, I'm buying. You're selling, I'm selling. Why are you buying? I don't care. I can't even imagine going up to somebody saying, I'm a momentum investor. Might as well, I'm a lemming and I'm proud to be a lemming. The second group I call Yogi Bear lemmings. But 10 years ago, this Yogi Bear movie came out. I begged my kids, can we go watch this movie? It used to be on my favorite comic book when I was a little kid. They refused. I went on my own. But if you've ever seen the movie or read the comic book, Yogi Bear's most famous saying was he was smarter than the average bear. Yogi Bear lemmings think they're smarter than the average lemming. Here's what they want to do. They want to run with the crowd to the very edge of the cliff and the last moment veer away. Great if you can pull it off, right? You get all the upside of momentum and none of the downside. Admit it, you're tempted. You're saying, I'm smarter than the average investor. I know where the cliff is coming. You might. I don't. And I don't think most people do. Have you noticed after every market collapse, people get up on CNBC and say, I knew that was coming. How come you never mentioned you were on CNBC every day for the last 5 years? It just slipped my mind. It was so obvious a correction was there. Really? So obvious you forgot to mention it. After the fact, it's always obvious that a correction was coming, that the cliff was back there. But you know what? Back there doesn't help you. Gravity's already working on you. You're in the water. I can't pull off being a proud lemming. I'm not smarter than the average lemming. I have no idea where the cliff is coming, and I'll be upfront in admitting that. If you ask me to describe myself, that's me. A lemming with a life vest. That's all I aspire to be. That's what valuation gives me. It gives me a life vest. Let me explain. When everybody is in a good mood pushing up prices, it's impossible not to feel in a good mood and want to push up prices as well. When everybody's optimistic, again, it's impossible not to feel optimistic. When everybody is panicking, it's impossible not to join the panic. I know it's going to happen to me. And all that valuation does is it slows the process down for me and says, do you really want to do that? 9 times out of 10, you know what my answer is? Of course, if everybody is panicking, I'm going to panic too. But maybe that 1 time out of 10, if I slow the process down and look at the numbers, I'm going to do the right thing. So my aspirations to valuation are not sky high. They're very low. All I need to do is develop a life vest, something I can hold on to when the rest of the world abandons me and goes off in the other direction. So with that basis, let's lay some misconceptions about valuation to rest. Here's the first one. You already saw this today when you looked at all those scenarios. There is this misconception that valuation is somehow a search for the truth, that you're sitting in front of a spreadsheet trying to estimate what the true value of something is. Just let it go. There are no unbiased valuations. All valuations are biased. You think that's a little extreme. Remember that company you're already thinking about or should be thinking about for your project? There is already bias there. You know why? Because you didn't pick the company randomly. You picked the company because you'd read about it, because you're interested in it, because you already have a point of view about the company, good or bad. I'll give you a personal example of how bias can affect valuations. I have valued Microsoft every year since 1986. That's the year of their IPO. Every single year. Every single time I valued Microsoft, I found it to be overvalued. You name the price, I found it overvalued at the price. $2, $5, $7. Don't buy, don't buy, don't buy. I could give you access to every single valuation of Microsoft I've done over the last 30 years. You could dig through these models looking for clues as to why I found it overvalued, but be looking in the wrong place. As I said, my office is in the 9th floor of the other building. When you get a chance, take the elevator up to the 9th floor. Open the door, it's open. Don't take anything out of my office, please. Walk in, you should have a radiation suit or something when you walk in because you'll see 5 computers. And the back of every computer, there's a picture of a fruit. Not a pear like in that Disney show where they, you know. But an apple. I've been an Apple user since 1981. In fact, if you look long enough in my office and look towards the top, you'll see my first Apple. It was a 128K, this little box, which did not have a hard drive, 1981. To me, Microsoft has always been the Darth Vader of technology. For those of you who are Star Wars fans, I'm not talking Anakin Skywalker, Darth Vader. I'm talking Darth Vader, the guy who never takes a shower, dresses in black. No. I have lots of bad thoughts about Bill Gates. And every time I sit down to value Microsoft, they come bubbling up to the surface. Because in valuation, you constantly come to forks in the road. High growth or low growth, who'd buy this rotten product? Low growth. High risk or low risk, one virus away from blowing up, high risk. By the time I make the choice of Microsoft, it's a given that I'm going to find Microsoft to be overvalued. I am far too biased to value Microsoft, and I know it. You know who else I'm far too biased to value? Come on, I've given away a clue. Apple. But actually, those of you who've read my blog for the last 6 years know that I've valued Apple every 3 months for the last 6 years. And if you go back and read the first blog post I did, my very first valuation, half the post is a plea. You know what it says? Don't trust me. I love this company too much, and you've got to take it into account when you see my valuation. And therein lies the answer to bias. You can't make it go away. All you can do is be open and upfront about it. To yourself, at least, don't lie to yourself. It's so easy to be self-delusional here. So what I would suggest is right after you pick a company, I want you to take a piece of paper, say, this is a company I pick. I think I'm going to find it to be cheap. I think I'm going to find it to be... So even though you haven't done a single valuation, write down on that piece of paper what you think you're going to find about this company. I think this is going to be a great company to buy or a horrible company to buy. Write it, put it away. At the end of the 15th week, once you've done your valuation, pick up that sheet of paper and look at it. In fact, one semester I actually made this explicit. I made people pick the company they were valuing and tell me whether they were going to have a buy or a sell at the end of the 15th week and give it to me in the first week. And I hid that spreadsheet away. Then at the end of the 15th week, when the actual buys and the sells came, I did a correlation between what they told me they would find and what they actually found. 99%, very few people change their minds. And of course, if you get paid to do a valuation, I've upped the ante. You tell me who pays you and how much you get paid. I'll tell you which direction the bias is and how much the bias is. And I'll tell you a story to bring this home. A company called Lynn Cable, about 25 years ago, AT&T had this option to buy Lynn Cable, or 49% of Lynn Cable, at an appraised value. So that's how the option was written. So the time for the exercise comes about. AT&T goes out and hires Morgan Stanley. So you guys are going to be Morgan Stanley. You work for AT&T, you're going to appraise the value of 49% of Lynn Cable so AT&T can buy it, so you work for the buyer. Lynn Cable goes out and hires Lehman Brothers. I'm sorry to do this to you, but think of yourselves as pre-bankrupt Lehman Brothers. You're appraising the value of the same 49% so Lynn Cable can sell it. So you work for the seller, you work for the buyer. Two investment banking teams go to work. They run spreadsheets and models and scenarios, and they come back with two very different numbers. One comes back with $105 per share. The other comes back with $155 per share. Now, who do you think came back with $105 per share? Come on, again, don't think too long. Go with your gut. Who do you think came back? Morgan Stanley or Lehman? And why? Because they work for the buyer. Their job is to come with a lowball number. So you did your job, 105, 155. The difference was so large, they decided to call in a third investment banker. Why settle for two fees when you can have three, I guess? And they call in this outfit called Wasserstein Perella, a boutique investment bank. That kind of freaks me out, the word boutique in front of it. Boutique clothes, boutique investment bank. I'm going to say something incredibly harsh about these guys, but again, I mean every word of it. These guys couldn't value a $20 bill in a brown paper bag if you put in front of them. They didn't rent some multiple. Enterprise value to cash in the bag, 3.3. Next thing you know, you'd be paying $66 for a $20 bill. But if you're Wasserstein Perella, you're right in the middle here, right? You don't want to piss off either side too much. 105, 155. Where's the safest place for you to be? 130. They came back with $127.50. Which you can either take as an indication of their inability to do math, which is entirely possible, or evidence of a much greater truth in valuation. And here's what it is. If you're ever asked to value something, never ever come back with a nice round number. Don't tell me the target price is $40. Tell me it's $38.87. It's amazing what that second decimal point will do in terms of creating an illusion that you actually know what you're doing. Trust me, take this advice to heart. Where is it? Just keep increasing the number of decimals. The precision factor will increase with it. This is the tragedy in valuation. In most valuations, the value gets set first, the valuation follows. So your investment banking team, the managing director comes and says, I want you to value the company, and by the way, I think it's worth 33, and then he leaves. And 3 days later, and 60 hours later, guess what you come up with? 33. Right after he leaves, why don't you just set the value to 33, let one of those iteration functions roll through, act like you're busy for 3 days. It's already predestined. The biggest enemy of valuation is bias. So all valuations are biased. All you can do is be honest about that bias. Second misconception about valuation. If I do a good valuation, I'm going to get the right answer. When does this get started? Probably first grade, right? You go to school. Teacher comes up and puts a sheet of paper in front of you. 7 plus 2. After much struggling, you come up with 9. She says, congratulations, you got the right answer. You did everything right. Do you come up with any other answer? She says, you got the wrong answer. You must have done something wrong. And this gets drummed into you all the way through school. If you got the wrong answer, you must have done something wrong. And then you end up in my valuation class, carrying those lessons of life. Every semester I've taught this class, like clockwork, I can predict what's going to happen. And I'll predict it'll happen in this class as well. About 12 weeks into this class, about 20 or 25 of you, mostly the number crunching type, will show up in my office with a full valuation. You come and put the valuation down on my desk and say, I'm done with my valuation. Could you take a look and tell me whether I got the right answer? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to push it back across the table to you, and I'm going to make an admission, which is, I don't know what the right answer is. And your faith in the system is going to start to crack. You say, you're teaching this class, you don't know what the right answer is. To which my response is, if I knew what the right value for every company was, why would I be teaching this class? Now think about that. Right? And at that stage, the group splinters. One half cannot handle the fact that there is no right answer. You know what happens to them? They become fixed income people. Right? There's a place in hell for fixed income people. It's so much more fun sitting there with a bond, right? Because if the maturity is given, the coupon is given, all you have to worry about is the default risk in the denominator, no margins, no growth. I let them go. It's a healthy recognition early in life that you're a fixed income kind of guy. Okay, go on. The other half says, this is kind of fun. If you don't know what the right answer is, I can never, ever conclusively be wrong. Think about this. This is one of the great things about valuing a company. If you value equity, there is no conclusive proof that you're wrong. You pick a stock, you ask me to buy it, it goes down 31 years in a row. You know what he tell me? Not a long enough time horizon. Stock goes bankrupt, the system got in the way, right? In fact, I'm going to argue that valuation has its biggest payoff when you're most uncomfortable doing a valuation. Let me explain. Think about valuing companies. You're going to feel more comfortable valuing some types of companies than others. In fact, let's be specific. Let me throw two companies out here, and you tell me which of these two companies you'll feel more comfortable valuing, Coca-Cola and Twitter. Which is going to be easier to value, more comfortable to value? Why? Because you know what it does, you know what it sells, you have this long history you can draw on, you can plug the numbers and chug the numbers, and you know, so you think, this is good, Coca-Cola, I'll feel much more comfortable value. Let me ask you a question. The things that made Coca-Cola easy to value, do you think they apply to the rest of the world as well? Do you think the rest of the world also finds Coca-Cola easy to value? Absolutely, they have the same information, they have the same history. So in other words, Coca-Cola is easy to value, not just for you, but for the entire world. You'll see where it's going next. Twitter is a difficult company to value. It doesn't know what it's selling. Maybe that's a problem. What am I selling? Tweets, right? Ads, nobody's buying ads, right? So when you sit down to value Twitter, there are all these estimation issues, and you can't fall back on history, right? There's no history to draw on. That's something you're going to find when you value companies. It's so much easier valuing a company with a long and established history that you can pull numbers out of than when you don't. That's what makes startups and young companies so difficult to value. But here's how you have to think about Twitter. It's not just you who faces those difficulties. It's everybody else. And I will argue that the payoff to valuing Twitter is greater than the payoff to valuing Coca-Cola because most people don't even try to value Twitter. You think, but they buy it. They buy it because they price it. The payoff to doing valuation is greatest when the uncertainty is at its maximum. I call this going where it's darkest. I say, go where it's darkest. When people ask, where should I go value companies? Go where it's darkest. Value a nice Ukrainian mining company. You will never again complain about uncertainty after doing that, right? And I try to take my own advice. I go where it's darkest. So the kinds of companies that I will value will be companies like Deutsche at the moment of crisis. You think, why don't you wait 4 months until the crisis goes away? It'll be too late. You want to get... So if you go back in my blog, you'll see Volkswagen valued right at the time that the scandal hit. Sometimes it doesn't work out. I valued Valiant at the time of the scandal and then again, but that's what going where it's darkest means. Valuing companies where the uncertainty is greatest. Yes?
For the purposes of this class, is there more benefit to valuing a harder to value company? Because obviously there's higher risk. Like there's a higher chance that we go horribly wrong, right?
Back up there. What did I just say about... There is no right answer here. You know what I'm going to grade you on? Process. How did you go about trying to value... Because I have no way of knowing whether your answer is horribly wrong or horribly right.
Right.
If there's such a way of describing being right. So all I can do is, did you deal with the estimation uncertainty in all you can do when you face estimation uncertainty is take the information you have right now, make your best judgments, then take that karmic pose. You heard of karma, right? There's a certain amount of things you don't control, and then move on. So I'm not going to judge you. So I'm not looking for, if I'm just measured on how precise is your valuation, all of you should be valuing Con Ed. Put the dividend in the morning. What are you going to learn about valuation from doing that? So that's why I'm saying take some risk. Pick companies where the uncertainty is greatest. It will make life uncomfortable for you. Why? Because it's not because I'm going to be tough on you. It's because you're going to be tough on yourself. But that's how you learn valuation. So make your own choices. As I said, there are no wrong choices. But that choice has to think about the trade-off you want to make, about how easy you want the semester to be and how much you want to learn about valuation. And I'll let you make the decision. I can't make that for you. Third misconception about valuation, if I make my model bigger, it's going to get better. It's so easy to build big models now, right? You build an Excel spreadsheet, and God help you if there's a team in the basement of your business building valuation models for you. You know what I'm talking about? I call this the geek squad. You hire them, and you send them down to the basement. Why? I don't think they're supposed to see the light of day. Because if they do, they turn into vampires or something. They love building models. They sit in front of big computers and they build big models. Inputs come in, they never leave. The model starts with 15 inputs, 25, 30, 40, 50, 60. Before you know it, 85 inputs to value one company in this elaborate model. And then they send that model up to your desk in whichever floor you're on and say, from this day on, when you want to value companies, use our in-house model. Two things happen with these models. One is what I call input fatigue. You have felt it? I'll describe it. And if you've ever had an intern or a job, you probably, especially at investment bank, you'd recognize it. It'll hit you around 11:30 on a Saturday night, and you're still at your desk. That kind of tells you something about your job. You think you're done. You get ready to turn off everything. Finally, the week is over. And just as you get ready to leave, your managing director shows up with an annual report. He throws it on your desk, doesn't place it on your desk. He throws it on your desk. I want this company valued first thing tomorrow morning. Why? It's Sunday morning. This is his trial by fire. He wants to see how much you really want this job. Part of you wants to exercise your option to abandon. I'll describe the option. It's deeply satisfying when you exercise it, and then bad things afterwards. Usually takes the form of picking up the annual report, throwing it back in your managing director's face, saying, you do it yourself, and walking out of that. That's the deeply satisfying moment, but nothing good comes out of that. You think about it for just this millisecond, and then you say, that's not going to work. I need a job here. And you sit down to value this company just with the annual report. With your in-house model, with 85 inputs, you start entering the inputs carefully. You get to the 11th input, the clock strikes midnight. You're not Cinderella. There's no pumpkin waiting outside. You look down, there are 74 more inputs to go, your stomach drops. Then you look at the 12th input, says, what was the inventory 5 years ago? Part of you wants to go look it up, but that part's too exhausted to get out of the chair. The other part of you prompts you, enter a random number, let's move on. And it's amazing how quickly the random numbers roll out. And the scary thing is the output comes out. It all looks the same, right? That input you toil 3 hours over, the random numbers all start to swim together. And here's another little secret in valuation that you might want to remember. If you're valuing a company with a lot of random number inputs and you want to hide it, here's what you should do. Create more detail in your output. Have 500 line items. Nobody will have any idea what's random, what's not. In fact, that's a dead giveaway. When somebody gives you a valuation, you can't even pick it up. It's so heavy. The question you have to ask is, what are you trying to hide from me? Good valuations should be parsimonious. Know what I mean by parsimonious? Less is more. I have never valued a company with more than 12 line items, ever. You're saying, but don't you want to break things down? What's the point? I mean, I could break working capital down to accounts receivable and accounts payable and everything else, but what am I gaining by doing that? If I can't predict days receivable for the next 30 years, why am I wasting my time breaking things down into more detail? The other thing that happens to these big models, they become black boxes. You know what I mean by a black box? After a while, you don't know who's running who. Are you running the model? Is the model running you? The dead giveaway. That the models become a black box, you start words like these in the report. The model valued the company at. Really? So what exactly do you do? I just fed the model. It's like the Little Shop of Horrors, a plan. Feed me, Seymour, feed me. So you feed inputs and say, get me a cup of coffee. Next thing you know, it's left the valuation on your desk. Less is more. Build more parsimonious models. So when you start building your model and you feel this urge to build detail, because that's what your accounting professors teach you, forget what your accounting professors teach you. This is not an accounting class. I don't care if your balance sheet balance in the year 2033. I don't even care if there is a balance sheet in the year 2033. What I want are cash flows and discount rates. And once you get there, who cares about the rest of the financial statements? So we're going to build on this because this, to me, is why valuations fail. In fact, I call this the Bermuda Triangle of valuation. What is the Bermuda Triangle, right? This mythical area in the Atlantic where planes and ships go to disappear. There is this mythical triangle in valuation where good sense goes to disappear. And the three sides of the triangle are what I just described. Bias, uncertainty and complexity. That's the fight you're going to be waging all through the semester, is finding a balance as you confront all three of them in whatever company you choose to value. So what I'm going to do actually is lay the table on what's coming. There are three basic ways you can put a number on an asset. The first is to do an intrinsic valuation. Sounds fancy, but an intrinsic valuation, you put a number on an asset based on its fundamentals, its cash flows, its growth, its risk. And when you see a discounted cash flow valuation, for better or worse, that's what we're trying to do. The second way you can put a number on an asset, and I talked about this in the last session, is to price it. You can look at other assets just like it and put a number on it. If you really want to see pricing at play, go to the StubHub site, right? Try to buy a ticket to the Super Bowl. It's not going to be cheap. So I want to take it to the Super Bowl. It's actually, you would see, in fact, if you want an even better example of pricing, use SeatGeek. Have you ever used SeatGeek? It's an aggregator of different sites. And they actually rank deals from great deals to awful deals. So if you want a Super Bowl ticket, you say, this is a great deal. You know how they decide what's a great deal? They look at the price people are asking for a ticket relative to other people in that same section asking for tickets. It's very simply pricing. And the third way you can think about putting a number on an asset is, especially if its cash flows are contingent on something happening, and we'll be more specific about it, you could use option pricing. Every single valuation model in the world has to fall into one of these three boxes. So let's start with what we have to assume in every one of these valuation models. Since this is a finance class, and you've gone through a whole bunch of finance classes to get here, somewhere along the way you probably talked about efficient markets, right? It's an undercurrent in almost every finance class. Sometimes when I start teaching this class, somebody says, do you believe markets are efficient? And I said, if I believe markets were efficient, this class wouldn't last very long, right? Because this were an efficient market. Now that you picked your company, what's the best estimate of value for your company? Go open up the Wall Street Journal or get online, look up the price today, you're done. The very fact that you do valuation tells you what? That you think markets make mistakes, and that you think you can make money off those mistakes. It might be a hopeless task. It's more difficult than you think it is, but that is the undercurrent no matter which approach you use to valuation. So with each valuation approach, I'm going to talk about the kind of market mistake we're assuming and the kind of correction we will need to make money off that mistake. So let's get the ball rolling by starting with discounted cash flow valuation. Discounted cash flow valuation is that very first finance class we all get. Remember that class? We bring in a financial calculator, we start talking about present value, right? It's amazing how much of finance is present value. So 80% of everything you've done in corporate finance and valuation is present value. Discounted cash flow valuation, the value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows on the asset. Nothing more, nothing less. You know what we're trying to do with discounted cash flow valuation? We're trying to estimate an intrinsic value for an asset. I call this, and I compare this to the search for the Holy Grail. How long have people been searching for the Holy Grail? I don't know, as long as 2,000 years, I don't know, since. How many people have found the Holy Grail? I don't think any have. So I'm already telling you that when you estimate intrinsic value, you're trying to estimate something that you really cannot check, and you have to be okay with it. And if you break down a discounted cash flow model down, here's what you will see. You will see a life for the asset. So if it's a 10-year building, you'll see 10 years as the life. You'll see expected cash flows for those 10 years and a discount rate that reflects the riskiness of the cash flows. Again, nothing fancy. But let's think about what has to happen for you to actually make money of a discounted cash flow valuation. First, you have to assume that markets make mistakes, right? Is that a safe assumption? I think it's one of the safest assumptions you can make. Even the firmest believer in efficient markets believes that markets make mistakes. That's easy. Second, you have to assume you can find those mistakes with your metrics and models. Now we're on dangerous ground. Why? How much does the average active portfolio manager beat the S&P 500 by each year? This is a trick question. The answer is -2.5%. That's what the most recent numbers are. It's the strangest profession on the face of the earth. -2.5%. But let's say you're the special one. You actually have a model that works. Let's give the mistake a name. Let's call it Cisco. Stock is at 30. You have a value of 45 for the company. Let's say you're right. It should really be trading at 45. You go buy 1 million shares at 30. Have you made any money yet? Now, what's the third thing that has to happen for you to actually make money? The market has to correct its mistakes. And how do you get the market to do it? You pray. You get on the Yahoo message board and you post and you post and you post. Yeah, Cisco is cheap, Cisco is cheap. The reality is most of us have no power to make that third assumption happen. But I'll give you the only consolation prize. The longer the time period you have that you can wait, the greater the chance that markets will correct the mistakes. So if you ask me, should I do discounted cash flow evaluation in my investing when I invest, you know what my question to you is going to be? What's your time horizon? Say 6 months, so don't waste your time. You know why? Not because you can't value companies, but because you're not giving the market enough time to correct its mistakes. So let's dig a little deeper on discounted cash flow evaluation. Clearly, it's what we spend most of our time in valuation classes teaching. So here are the advantages. One of the big advantages of intrinsic valuation is you're not caught up in the market mood and momentum. You're not buying online media stocks because everybody else is buying them. You are valuing a company as a business. In fact, there's this old Warren Buffett saying, don't buy a stock, buy a share of a business. And what he was saying was, when you invest in a stock, think of what you're investing in. Think of the business you're investing in because that's where the value comes from. Discounted cash flow valuation kind of brings that home. And to value a company, now you really have to understand what it does, right? What business is it in? What's the competition? And finally, if you do your discounted cash flow valuation right and you have faith, you're in a sense immunized. You know what I mean by immunized? You've got the cash flows. Who cares what the rest of the world thinks about the stock? So those are the advantages of discounted cash flow valuation. Let's think about, go ahead.
So do you recommend us to follow the news of the company or not to follow it?
I will recommend nothing to you during the course of this semester. You know why? Because I have no idea what your time horizon is, how patient you are as a human being. If your patience is, I can take only about 15 minutes before I need certainty, don't do discounted cash flow evaluation. So one of the things I will push you on in this class is for you to find your own comfort zone. I will describe my comfort zone and tell you what works for me, but it's not going to be what works for you. This is about you discovering what works for you rather than me thrusting what works for me on you. So start thinking about, do you have a long time horizon? Don't just say yes, because that's what you're supposed to say. Think about the times when you had to wait for, remember you put your college application in and you had to wait for like 3 months before. How did it feel during those 3 months? Were you kind of developing ulcers and freaking out like my youngest son is right now? Or were you okay with it, saying what will be, will be? So you have to dig into your own experiences with having to wait and how you dealt with it before you make the decision. Yeah.
So say I do follow the news, then I'll be affected by the market sentiment and be biased.
No, following the news doesn't make you biased. Reading other people's opinions makes you biased. So don't get this wrong. Following the news, what are you finding out? That your company's revenues went up. Don't be crazy and say, that's going to bias me. Knowing that your company's revenues went up is something you need to know. Listening to some guy on CNBC tell you that he thinks a stock is a buy or a sell will bias you. So first thing I want you to do is stop watching CNBC. I tell this right on CNBC. They don't like it. But I think more damage has been done to investor portfolios from watching CNBC than just sitting there saying, hey, market's doing whatever it is. So let me be clear. Following the news is not going to make you biased. Listening to other people's opinions makes you biased. So I read the Wall Street Journal every day because there's news in it about companies that I need to know. But I don't read equity research reports. I don't read somebody's investment advice and this is a good company. Because that's what I need to do with the news. So be very careful about what I'm asking you to do. So don't just say, I'm not going to look at news. It's going to bias me. News is what drives your valuation. Other people's opinions are potentially what could bias you. Now let's think about the disadvantages of DCF valuation. It will require you to be much more explicit about your assumptions, about growth and cash flows and risk. What do you mean? Well, I'm going to argue that even when you do pricing, when you use a PE ratio or an EV to EBITDA multiple, you're making assumptions about growth and risk and cash flows, you just are not explicit about them. That's actually an advantage, right? Because if you're not explicit about growth, people don't even realize you are horribly wrong. When you do discounted cash flow valuation, your assumptions are out there for everybody to pick apart. You've got to be okay with it. That's the first disadvantage. The second is I'm going to teach you how you can take a value. This is actually a very perverse exercise. I'm going to take a valuation. I'm going to say, by moving this, this, and this, this is how much you can move value. And at the end of the process, you're going to be very cynical and say, I can make any company worth any number. But I want you to be aware of how much people can manipulate numbers if they put their heart to it. That's where bias shows up. And finally, when you do intrinsic valuation, it's entirely possible that every company that you value could be overvalued. You're saying, so what? If every company you look at is overvalued, and you're a long-only mutual fund, you know what I mean by a long-only mutual fund, you can only buy stocks. What's the logical next step for you? You should not buy stocks, you should liquidate your fund. Try that as a Fidelity manager. Liquidate your fund, go to your boss and say, you know what, I found nothing cheap. Therefore, I decided to shut the fund down. You won't last as a Fidelity mutual fund manager for very long. So if your mission requires you to be invested in stocks no matter what, you might find that intrinsic valuation can start to get in the way. So those are things that you will see starting to show up when you look at, should I do discounted cash flow valuation? Let's talk about pricing. So if you think about, if you think about when discounted cash flow valuation is going to work best, it obviously works best on assets that have cash flows attached to them. See, that's a silly thing to say. Don't all assets have cash flows? If you ask me to value a Picasso, I can't do a discounted cash flow valuation of a Picasso. In fact, on my blog, I valued gold. Let me take that back. I've been asked, what's the value of gold? Gold can't be valued. It can be priced. It can be priced as a currency. Gold is an alternative to paper currencies. Or what's the value of Bitcoin? Who the hell knows? It's an alternative currency. You can price Bitcoin. You can't value it. So don't try to do discounted cash flow valuation on assets that don't have cash flows. And it works best for investors who have a long time horizon. We talked about why. You give the market more time to correct its mistakes. And it works even better if you can be the catalyst that causes the mistake to go away. You guys heard of Carl Icahn or Bill Ackman or all these activist investors? The next time a Carl Icahn or a Bill Ackman takes a position in a company, watch what they do after they take the position. What's the first thing they do? They don't stay silent. They get on the Wall Street Journal, give an interview. They get on CNBC, scream as loud as they can. They essentially try to convince the world that the stock is cheap or expensive to make the price. It doesn't always work. But you can see how by providing a catalyst, they've improved their odds. If you own 1,000 shares in Apple, you open your window to your apartment, start yelling out there, Apple is cheap, Apple is cheap, I just bought 1,000 shares. Nobody's listening to you. Carl Icahn does exactly the same thing. The stock price goes up 3%. Life's not fair. Right? And it works best if you're the kind of person who does not respond well to peer pressure. I told you it was all about you. I mean, let's face it, some of us were those people in high school where if the rest of the class didn't like us, you felt bad. You had to be part of the peer group. And others were, you know, marching to your own drummer, which basically meant nobody liked you at school because you're this crazy person. Hey, this might work in your favor. If you're one of those very strange people, hey, then you know what? Intrinsic valuation might work because you don't care what the rest of the world thinks. Because what's a market price? The market price is the rest of the world telling you, hey, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. Every day I wake up, everybody's screaming at me about value without ever saying a word. All I have to look at the price in the market saying, you crazy idiot. Why do you buy value? You have to be willing to accept the fact that, no, the market could take a very different view. So that's discounted cash flow valuation. Let's think about pricing. In pricing, you try to attach a number to an asset based on how similar assets are being priced. So here are the steps to pricing. In pricing, philosophically, you've given up on the notion of intrinsic value. You say, I don't know what that is. You're saying, I'm going to trust the market to attach a number to the asset. And if you break down pricing, here's what you need. If you get lucky, you might find an exactly identical asset out there. Identical in what sense? Same cash flow, same growth, same risk. This is what's called arbitrage, and use that price to attach to it. You can give up on that with any kind of company because there is no individual stock where there's another stock exactly like it. Ford is not like GM, even though there might be large automobile companies. So what you will often do is a group of companies or a group of assets that you think are similar to your asset. So if you're valuing a small steel company, you might say, these are 15 other small steel companies. Second step, since you can't compare stock prices across companies, you've got to standardize them. Why can't you compare stock prices across companies? If I just use price as my measure of expensive or cheap, what's the most expensive stock in the U.S.? Berkshire Hathaway trades at $227,000 a share. And the cheapest stock would be some penny stock that I can get for a penny. But that's absurd, right? Because the price per share is, in a sense, arbitrary. Why is it arbitrary? If I do a 2-for-1 stock split, what happens to my price per share? It effectively halves. So rather than compare prices per share, I divide price by something. Price by earnings, price by book value. A multiple is just a standardized price. I compare that standardized price across companies to make a judgment on what the pricing should be for my stock. And I might have to control for differences in growth and risk as best as I can. But when I do pricing, I assume that markets are right on average. Do you see why? Because if I'm using pricing, I'm essentially looking across the market, but I assume that they make mistakes on individual stocks. So saying automobile stocks collectively are priced right, but you know what? The market might be making a mistake on GM versus Ford. So in pricing, the mistake you're making about markets is that the mistake is across, it's called a cross-sectional mistake, and you make money when that mistake gets corrected. So here are the advantages of pricing. When you price, you're going to notice that what I talked about as the advantage for DCF becomes... So basically, it's the flip side of the equation. Remember I said the advantage of DCF is you don't care what the market does? In the case of pricing, the advantage is you're in sync with the market. You say, why is that an advantage? Let's say you're the banker that Snap has hired to put a price, to put a number on their IPO. Okay? So it's going to happen in a few weeks. I mean, the numbers I see floating around are 20, 25, 30 billion, right? Your job is to price Snap, not to value Snap, because you've got to take the company at that pricing. You have to be in sync with the market. If markets love companies that are social media companies, guess what? Your pricing should reflect it. No matter what you might think about the capacity of those companies to convert their number of users into revenues and earnings and cash flows, it's not about you. You have a job to do. So if your job requires that you attach a number to an asset based on what people are willing to pay for it, you really should be using pricing. Second, if your job is to be invested in equities no matter what, with pricing, about half of all stocks are going to come out as cheap or expensive no matter what point in time you're in. Do you see why? Because I'm comparing stocks to each other. So even if everything goes up 30%, half those stocks will be cheap, half will be expensive. And that might be more in sync with what you're required to do. And thirdly, you need less explicit information to price a stock. We're going to go through how to attach a PE ratio for a stock, a price to book, and you're going to notice that it requires less work, less explicit inputs than doing a DCF valuation. And that might work to your advantage, especially if people start asking you questions about why you put a number on an asset. And finally, a lot of investors play what I call the incremental game. Do you know what that is? They don't even assume the stock right now is mispriced. What they're looking for is the next earnings announcement or the next acquisition announcement. They're hoping to play the game right. In what sense? Let's say tomorrow is an earnings announcement day for Apple. One of three things can happen. Either the earnings report will disappoint. Second is the earnings report can come in just on expectation. The third is earnings reports can beat expectations. You're not even asking big questions about the stock. You're asking what will happen to the stock price tomorrow. And guess what? If you can play that game well, you can make a lot of money. So you're playing the incremental game. You're more interested in pricing rather than valuation because it's a change in price that makes you money. The disadvantages of pricing is when you tell me, based on a pricing, that a stock is a buy. So let's say you're one of those banking equity research analysts. You tell me JP Morgan is a buy, and you have 15 banks in your group. What have you really told me? You've really told me that J.P. Morgan is the cheapest of the 15 companies you looked at, right? The 15 banks. If all 15 banks are overvalued, which can happen on an intrinsic basis, you really don't care. It's not your fault. You're not lying to me when you say it's a buy, but I have to be very careful about what that buy is. It's relative to whatever I compare it to. And to the extent that entire markets can get overvalued or undervalued, pricing can lead you down the wrong path. So you can buy the cheapest social media stock out there, and it could be Facebook. But you could still be wrong because all social media stocks might be overvalued by 50 or 80%. And finally, one of the things I'm going to talk about is every time you do a pricing, I'm going to make you think about your implicit assumptions. So if you're paying 25 times earnings for a company, I want you to think about what kind of growth would need to be delivered for that 25 times earnings to be okay. And we're going to go through a very simple process of extracting from pricing the implicit assumptions you're making about growth, risk, and cash flows. So let's think about when pricing works best. Pricing works best when I have lots of similar assets out there, and I can get a price on each of them. That's why pricing works in with StubHub. Okay? Anytime I get lots of similar assets, I get a pricing on them, then I can use pricing to attach a number. It works for investors who have relatively short time horizons. So if you have a 6-month or a 9-month or a 1-year time horizon, I say use pricing, don't do valuation. And if you're judged based on a relative basis, it's even better. You know what I mean by judged on a relative basis? If you look at how Morningstar ranks mutual funds, what do? They don't look at the absolute returns they make. They look at the returns you made relative to other mutual funds with the same kind of mission. So if you're a growth mutual fund and you lost 5%, you look like a hero if everybody else lost 15%. If you're judged on a relative basis, you can see why pricing is a much better tool for you. Because your job is pricing, and you get judged on a pricing basis. I'm going to give you some at least loose evidence that 9 out of 10 so-called valuations out there are really pricing. That people use the word valuation when they really mean pricing. And I'm going to argue that you shouldn't be too harsh on these people as being short-term or not thinking through it, because that's exactly what they might be required to do. Now, we're going to do a little detour somewhere in the middle of the semester, and I'm going to talk about asset-based valuation. Sounds fancy, but rather than value entire companies, I will value the company in pieces. So we have 5 real estate holdings. I'll value each individually, add them all up. So I'm going to use them in the context of liquidation valuation, where often you have to value the piece of a company and ask, what would I get if I liquidated the company? I'm going to talk about accounting fair value, which is a big buzzword now where accountants are trying to put numbers on brand name and physical assets breaking down value. And I'm also going to talk about a way in which you could value one of these big conglomerates as a sum of the parts valuation, a GE, a Sony, where you can value it in pieces, or a Disney. So I could take Disney, and rather than value the whole company, I could value ESPN, I could value Marvel, I could value Lucasfilms, and I could add them all up at the end. It's much more involved, so I'll go through the process of how to do it right. But the reason you might want to think about asset-based valuation in some cases is because that's what you will need to do if you're involved in a liquidation or you're buying a company to break it up. Okay. I'm going to this page for the moment, just let it hang out there. Okay. So I've given you only a very brief introduction to discounted cash flow valuation and pricing. And I just want you to think about, given that distinction, if you had to pick which one you would pick today. And I'm going to show you exactly the same question after you've gone through 15 weeks and tried this out on your company. Because the experience of actually doing a DCF and pricing a company might very well change your perspective on what you think about it. So be ready for this question, the very last session of this class, because I'd be interested in how working through numbers actually changed your perspective and what you believe in, in the abstract. One final point, and this I just want to mention. There is a very small subset of valuations where you might want to draw on what I call contingent claim or option pricing. And that's if your cash flows are contingent on something happening. Because you think about what makes an option, options derive their value from an underlying asset and get their payoffs from a contingent payoff. The stock price exceeds the strike price. And there are going to be some subsets where essentially you're going to find option pricing come into play. And if you remember your foundations class, the key to recognizing options is with a payoff diagram. Don't worry, I'm not going to hit you with option pricing equations, but the essence of option pricing is you get a kink in the payoff, which is if the stock price exceeds the strike price you make in the call option, you make money. If it's less, there's a fixed loss. The key to option pricing is you have limited losses, unlimited potential profits. And here are the scenarios where option pricing kicks in. You could have direct examples of options. I'm not going to spend time on any of these because there are other classes for this. Futures classes, options classes, convertible bonds, warrants, listed options. The options we're going to talk about in this class are going to be fairly unique companies which have option pricing. I'm going to end with that. Here are the places where you're going to find option pricing come into play. These are the real options. If you own equity in a deeply troubled firm, Bombardier, you heard of Bombardier, Canadian aircraft manufacturer, on the verge of disaster, it's got huge amounts of debt, don't know whether to make it, or even Vale, you could argue that when you buy equity in a deeply troubled firm, you're essentially buying an option. You're not buying it for cash flows or dividends. You're buying it for an option. We'll see why. When you buy equity in a biotechnology firm or a pharmaceutical firm, especially a young one, you're buying an option. Here's why. It might have a promising drug working its way through the pipeline, but it might or might not make it. The FDA says this drug is not approved. Your company value goes to zero. If it's approved, it could be worth billions. There's an option. Or when you value a natural resource company like Petrobras, oil company with huge undeveloped reserves, with one problem. Those reserves, if you try to develop them today, would cost you $70 a barrel to develop. And at today's oil prices, they're worth nothing. But that doesn't mean if you're investing in the company, you're going to treat them as worthless, because if oil prices go up, you essentially have a valuable asset. That's option pricing. So when we talk about real options, we're talking about applying them in contexts where you normally don't see it. So as you go through, think about what these models allow you to do is essentially attach numbers to assets that you otherwise would not be able to. So when we start on Monday, we will start with lecture note packet one, right? So bring that. So if you don't have the packet already, please print it off and bring it with you or buy it, okay?